finches in the damn sunroom, chitter all day. She breeds them. And pellets? Every kind. None talk, thank God. She never had much luck with parrots. Her luck is about to change. Barton sighed. She doesn't want another damn parrot. She wants this one, Richard said. It's the only one like it in the world.
I'm leaving at 6 tomorrow morning, Barton grumbled.
It'll be waiting on your plane, Richard said. Rob Bellarmino smiled reassuringly. Just ignore the cameras, he said to the kids. They had set up in the school library of George Washington High in Silver Spring, Maryland. 3 semicircles of chairs around a central chair where Dr. Bellarmino sat while he talked to the students about the ethical issues of genetics. The TV people had 3 cameras going, one at the back of the room, one at the side, close on Bellarmino, and one facing the kids to record their expressions of fascination as they heard about the life of a working geneticist at the NIH. According to the show's producer, it was important to show Bellarmino's interaction with the community, and he could not have agreed more. The kids were specially picked to be bright and knowledgeable. He thought it would be fun. He spoke about his background and training for a few minutes, and then took questions. The first one made him pause. "Dr. Bellarmino," a young Asian girl asked, "what is your opinion of that woman in Texas who cloned her dead cat?" In fact, Bellarmino thought the whole dead cat business was ridiculous. He thought it diminished the important work he and others were doing, but he couldn't say that.
"Of course, this is a difficult, emotional situation," Bellarmino said diplomatically. "We are all fond of our pets, but..."
He hesitated. "This work was done by a California company called Genetic Savings and Clone, and it was reported that the cost was $50,000.
"Do you think it's ethical to clone a pet cat?" the girl asked.
"As you know," he said, "quite a few animals have now been cloned, including sheep, mice, dogs, and cats, so it has become rather unremarkable. One concern is that a cloned animal does not have the same lifespan as a normal animal." Another student said, "Is it ethical to pay $50,000 to clone a pet when so many people are starving in the world?" Bellarmino groaned inwardly. How was he going to change the subject? "I am not enthusiastic about this procedure," he said, "but I would not go so far as to call it unethical."
"Isn't it unethical because it makes a climate of normality to clone a human being?"
"I don't think cloning a pet has any effect on the issues concerning human cloning."
"Would it be ethical to clone a human being?"
"Fortunately," Bellarmino said, "that issue is quite far in the future. Today, I hope we might consider real contemporary issues. We have people who express concerns about genetically modified foods. We have concerns about gene therapy and stem cells, and these are real issues. Do any of you share that concern?" A young boy in the back raised his hand.
"Yes?"
"Do you think it is possible to clone a human being?" the boy asked.
"Yes, I think it is possible. Not now, but eventually."
"When?"
"I wouldn't want to guess when. Are there any questions on a different subject?" Another hand.
"Yes? In your opinion, is human cloning unethical?"
Again, Bellarmino hesitated. He was acutely aware his response was going to be broadcast on television, and who could know how the network would edit his remarks? They'd probably do their best to make him look as bad as possible. Reporters had a distinct prejudice against people of faith, and his words also carried professional weight because he ran a division of NIH. "You've probably heard a lot about cloning, and most of it is untrue. Speaking as a scientist, I must admit I see nothing inherently wrong with cloning. I see no moral issue.
It is just another genetic procedure. We already have done it with a variety of animals, as I have mentioned. However, I also know that the procedure of cloning has a high failure rate. Many animals die before one is successfully cloned. Clearly, that would be unacceptable for human beings. So for the moment, I regard cloning as a non-problem.
Isn't cloning playing God?
I personally wouldn't define the issue that way, he said. If God has made human beings and made the rest of the world, then clearly God has made the tools of genetic engineering. So in that case, God has already made genetic modification available. That is the work of God, not man. And as always, it is up to us to use wisely what God has given us. He felt better after this. It was one of his stock answers. So, is cloning a wise use of what God has given us? Against his every instinct, he wiped his forehead with the sleeve of his jacket. He hoped they wouldn't use that bit of film, although he was sure they would. Young kids sweat the head of NIH. Some people think they know what God intends, he said, but I don't believe I know. I don't believe anyone can know that except God. I think anyone who says he knows God's intention is showing a lot of very human ego. He wanted to glance at his watch, but he didn't. The kids were looking quizzical, not enraptured as he had expected. There's a great range of genetic issues, he said. Let's move on.
Dr. Bellarmino, said a kid to the left, I wanted to ask about antisocial personality disorder. I've read there is a gene for it, and it's associated with violence and crime, sociopathic behavior.
Yes, that's true. The gene appears in about 2% of the population around the world.
What about New Zealand? It is in 30% of the white New Zealand population and 60% of the Maori population.
That's been reported, but you must be careful.
But doesn't that mean violence is hereditary? I mean, shouldn't we be trying to get rid of this gene the way we got rid of smallpox?
Bellarmino paused. He was starting to wonder how many of these kids had parents who worked in Bethesda. He hadn't thought to ask for the names of the kids in advance. But the questions from these kids were too knowledgeable, too relentless. Was one of his many enemies trying to discredit him by using these kids? Was the whole network plan a trap to make him look bad? The first step toward pushing him out of NIH, this was the information age. It was how such things were done today. Arranged to make you look bad, make you look weak, push you to say something foolish, and then watch your words repeated over and over for the next 48 hours on every cable news show and in every newspaper column. Next, have congressmen call for you to retract your statements, clucking tongues, shaking heads. How could he be so insensitive? Was he really suited for the job? Wasn't he really a liability at his post? And then you were out. That was how it was done these days. Now Bellarmino was facing a dangerously loaded question about Maori genetics. Should he say what he really believed and risk being accused of demeaning a downtrodden ethnic minority? Did he mute his comments but still risk criticism for promoting eugenics? How, actually, could he say anything at all? He decided he couldn't. You know, he said, that's an extremely interesting area of research, but we just don't know enough yet to answer. Next question.
It had been raining all day in southern Sumatra. The jungle floor was wet, the leaves were wet, everything was wet. The video crews from around the world had long since gone on to other assignments. Now Hager was back with only one client, a man named Gorovich, a famous wildlife photographer who had flown in from Tanzania. Gorovich had set up beneath a large ficus tree, unzipped a duffel bag, and removed a nylon mesh sling like a hammock. He set this on the ground carefully. Then he brought out a metal case, popped it open, and assembled a rifle.
"You know that's illegal," Hager said. "This is a preserve."
"No shit."
"If the Rangers come through, you better get that stuff out of sight."
"Not a problem." Gorevich charged the compressor, opened the chamber.
"How big is this guy?"
"He's a juvenile, 2 or 3 years old. Maybe 30 kilos, probably less."
"Okay. 10 cc's.
Gorevich pulled a dart out of the case, checked the level, and slipped it into the chamber. Then another, and another. He clicked the chamber closed. He said to Hager,
"When was the last time you saw him?"
10 days ago.
"Where?"
"Near here."
"He comes back? This is his home range?"
"Seems to be."
Gorevich squinted down the telescopic sight. He swung it in an arc, then up to the sky, then back. Satisfied, he put the gun down.
"You got a low enough dose?"
"Don't worry," Gorevich said.
"Also, if he's high in the canopy, you can't shoot, because..."
"I said, don't worry."
Gorevich looked at Hager.
"I know what I'm doing. Dose is just enough to unsteady him. He'll come down by himself long before he collapses. We may have to track him on the ground for a while."
"You've done this before?"
Gorevich nodded.
"With orangs?"
"Chimps."
"Chimps are different."
"Really?"
Sarcastic. The two men fell into an uneasy silence. Gorevich got out a video camera and tripod and set them up. Then a long-range microphone with a 1-foot dish, which he clipped to the top of the camera with a mounting pole. It made an ungainly apparatus, but effective, Hager thought. Gorevich squatted on his haunches and stared out at the jungle. The men listened to the sound of the rain and waited. In recent weeks, the talking orangutan had faded from the media. The story had gone the way of other animal reports that didn't prove out. That Arkansas woodpecker nobody could find again, and the 6-foot Congo ape that nobody could locate despite persistent stories by natives, and the giant bat with the 12-foot wingspan that was supposedly seen in the jungles of New Guinea. As far as Gorevich was concerned, the declining interest was ideal, because when the ape was finally rediscovered, media attention would be 10 times greater than it would have been otherwise. Especially because Gorevich intended to do more than record the talking ape. He intended to bring it back alive. He zipped his jacket collar tight against the dripping rain, and he waited. It was late in the afternoon and starting to get dark. Gorevich was dozing off when he heard a low, gravelly voice say,
"Hello, Maird."
He opened his eyes. He looked at Hager sitting nearby. Hager shook his head.
"Hello, comment ça va?"
Gorevich looked slowly around.
"Maird, scumbag, espèce de con."
It was a low sound, throaty, like a drunk at a bar.
"Fungelausted."
Gorevich turned on the camera. He couldn't tell where the voice was coming from, but he could at least record it. He swung the lens in a slow arc while he watched the microphone levels. Because the mic was directional, he was able to determine that the sound was coming from the south. 9 o'clock from where he was. He squinted through the finder, zoomed in. He could see nothing. The jungle was becoming darker every minute. Hager stood motionless nearby, just watching. Now there was a crashing of branches, and Gorevich glimpsed a shadow as it streaked across the lens. He looked up and saw the shape moving higher and higher, swinging on branches as it went up into the overhead canopy. In a few moments, the orang was 70 feet in the air above them.
"Chutz flucket. Asshole whiskey. Look."
He took the camera off the tripod, tried to film. It was black. Nothing. Flicked on night vision. He saw nothing but green streaks as the animal moved in and out of the thick foliage. The orang was moving higher and laterally.
"Flucket. Motherfucker.
Nice mouth on him, but the voice was growing fainter. Gourevitch realized he had a decision to make, and quickly. He set the camera down and reached for the rifle. He swung it up and sighted down the scope. Military night vision, bright green, very clear. He saw the ape, saw the eyes, glowing white dots. Hager said, "No!" The orang jumped to another tree, suspended in space for an instant. Gourevitch fired. He heard the hiss of gas and the thwack of the darts smacking the leaves.
"Missed him."
He raised the rifle again.
"Don't do this."
"Shut up." Gourevitch sighted, fired. In the trees above, there was a momentary pause in the thrashing sound.
"You hit him,"
Hager said. Gourevitch waited.
The crashing of leaves and branches began again. The orang was moving, now almost directly overhead.
"No, I didn't."
Gourevitch raised the gun once more.
"Yes, you did. If you shoot again..."
Gourevitch fired. A whoosh of gas near his ear. Then silence. Gourevitch lowered the gun and moved to reload it, keeping his eyes on the canopy overhead. He crouched down, flicked open his metal case, and felt for more cartridges. He kept looking upward the whole time. Silence.
"You hit him,"
Hager said.
"Maybe." "I know you hit him."
"No, you don't." Gourevitch popped three more cartridges into the gun.
"You don't know that."
"He's not moving. You hit him."
Gourevitch took his position, raised the rifle, just in time to see a dark shape come plummeting downward. It was the orang, falling straight down from the canopy more than 150 feet above them. The animal crashed to the ground at Gourevitch's feet, splattering mud. The orang didn't move. Hager swung a flashlight. Three darts protruded from the body, one in the leg, two in the chest. The orang was not moving. The animal's eyes were open, staring upward.
"Great,"
Hager said.
"Great work."
Gourevitch dropped to his knees in the mud, put his mouth over the orang's big lips, and blew air into his lungs to resuscitate him. Six attorneys sat at the long table, all shuffling through papers. It sounded like a windstorm. Rick Deal waited impatiently, biting his lip. Finally, Albert Rodriguez, his head attorney, looked up.
"The situation is this," Rodriguez said. "You have good reason, sufficient reason anyway, to believe that Frank Burnett conspired to destroy the cell lines in your possession, so that he could sell them again to some other company."
"Right," Rick said. "Fucking right. Three courts have ruled that Burnett's cells are your property. You therefore have a right to take them."
"You mean take them again?"
"Correct. Except the guy has gone into hiding." "That is inconvenient, but it does not change the material facts of the situation. You are the owner of the Burnett cell line," Rodriguez said, "wherever those cells may occur."
"Meaning his children? His grandchildren? They probably have the same cells."
"You mean
I can take cells from the kids?"
"The cells are your property,"
Rodriguez said. "What if the kids don't agree to let me take them?"
"They may very well not agree, but since the cells are your property, the children don't have any say in the matter."
"We're talking punch biopsies of liver and spleen here," Deal said. "They're not exactly minor procedures."
"They're not exactly major either," Rodriguez said. "I believe they are ordinary outpatient procedures. Of course, you would have a duty to make sure that the cell extractions were performed by a competent physician. I assume you would."
Deal frowned. "Let me see if I understand. You're telling me I can just grab his kids off the street and haul them to a doctor and remove their cells, whether they like it or not?"
"I am, yes."
"And how," Rick Deal said, "can that be legal?"
"Because they are walking around with cells that are legally yours, hence with stolen property. That's felony, too. Under the law, if you witness a felony being committed, you are entitled to perform a citizen's arrest and take the offender into custody. So if you were to see Burnett's children walking on the street, you could legally arrest them.
Me, personally?
No, no, Rodriguez said. In these circumstances, one avails oneself of a trained professional, a fugitive recovery agent.
You mean a bounty hunter?
They don't like that term, and neither do we.
All right. Do you know of a good fugitive recovery agent?
We do, Rodriguez said.
Then get him on the phone, Deal said, right now.
Vasco Borden faced the mirror and reviewed his appearance with a professional eye while he brushed mascara into the graying edges of his goatee. Vasco was a big man, 6'4" and 240, all muscle, 9% body fat. His shaved head and his trimmed black goatee made him look like the devil. One big mother of a devil. He meant to appear intimidating, and he did. He turned to the suitcase on the bed. In it, he had neatly packed a set of coveralls with a Con Ed logo on the breast, a loud plaid sport coat, a sharp black Italian suit, a motorcycle jacket that read Die in Hell on the back, a velour tracksuit, a breakaway plaster leg cast, a short barrel Mossberg 590 and two black Para 45s. For today, he was dressed in a tweed sport coat, casual slacks, and brown lace-up shoes. Finally, he laid three photos out on the bed. First, the guy, Frank Burnett, 51, fit, ex-Marine. The guy's daughter, Alex, early 30s, a lawyer. The guy's grandson, Jamie, now 8. The old guy had vanished, and Vasco saw no reason to bother finding him. Burnett could be anywhere in the world, Mexico, Costa Rica, Australia. Much easier to get the cells directly from other family members. He looked at the photo of the daughter, Alex, a lawyer, never good as a target. Even if you handled them perfect, you still got sued. This gal was blonde, looked to be in decent physical shape. Attractive enough, if you liked the type. She was too skinny for Vasco's taste. And she probably took some Israeli defense class on weekends, you never knew. Anyway, she spelled potential trouble. That left the kid. Jamie, 8 years old, second grade, local school. Vasco could get down there, pick him up, collect the samples, and be done with this whole thing by the afternoon, which was fine with him. Vasco had a $50,000 completion bonus if he recovered in the first week. That declined to $10,000 after 4 weeks, so he had plenty of reason to get it over with. Do the kid, he thought. Simple and to the point. Dolly came in, the paper in her hand. Today she was wearing a navy blue suit, low shoes, white shirt. She had a brown leather briefcase. As usual, her bland looks enabled her to move about without attracting notice. "How does this look?" she said, and handed him the paper. He scanned it quickly. It was a To Whom It May Concern, signed by Alex Burnett, allowing the bearer to pick up her son, Jamie, from school and take him to the family doctor for his exam.
"You called the doctor's office?" Vasco said.
"Yeah," said Jamie had a fever and sore throat, and they said bring him in.
So if the school calls the doctor,
we're covered.
And you're sent from the mother's office?
Right.
Got your card?
She pulled out a business card with the logo of the law firm.
And if they call the mother?
Her cell number is listed on the paper, as you see.
And that's Cindy?
Yes. Cindy was their office dispatcher in Playa del Rey.
Okay, let's get it done,
Vasco said. He put his arm around her shoulder.
You going to be okay doing this?
Sure, why not?
You know why not.
Dolly had a weakness for kids. Whenever she looked in their eyes, she melted. They'd had a fugitive in Canada, ran him down in Vancouver. The kid answered the door, and Dolly asked if her father was home. The kid was a little girl, about 8. She said, no, not there. Dolly said, okay, and left. Meanwhile, the guy was driving up the street on his way home. His darling kid shut the door, went to the phone, called her old man and told him to keep going. The kid was experienced. They'd been on the run since she was 5. They never got close to the guy again.
That was just one time, Dolly said.
There's been more than one.
Vasco,
she said,
everything's going to be fine today.
Okay, he said, and he let her kiss him on the cheek. Out in the driveway, the ambulance was parked, rear doors open. Vasco smelled cigarette smoke. He went around to the back. Nick was sitting there in a white lab coat, smoking.
Jesus, Nick, what are you doing?
Just one, Nick said.
Put it out, Vasco said. We're heading off now. You got the stuff?
I do. Nick Ramsey was the doc they used on jobs when they needed a doc. He'd worked in emergency rooms until his drug and alcohol habit took over. He was out of rehab now, but steady employment was hard to come by.
They want liver and spleen punch biopsies, and they want blood.
I read it. Fine needle aspirations. I'm ready. Vasco paused.
You been drinking, Nick?
No.
Shit, no.
I smell something on your breath.
No. No, come on, Vasco. You know I wouldn't. I got a good nose, Nick.
No.
Open your mouth.
Vasco leaned forward and sniffed.
I just had a taste is all, Nick said.
Vasco held out his hand.
Bottle.
Nick reached under the gurney, handed him a pint bottle of Jack Daniels.
That's great.
Vasco moved close, got in his face.
Now listen to me, he said quietly. You pull any more stunts today, and I'll personally throw you out the back of this ambulance onto the 405. You want to make a tragedy of your life? I'll see that it happens. You got me?
Yeah, Vasco.
Good. I'm glad we have an understanding.
He stepped back.
Hold out your hands.
I'm fine.
Hold out your hands.
Vasco never raised his voice in moments of tension. He lowered it.
Make them listen. Make them worry. Hold your hands out now, Nick.
Nick Ramsey held out his hands. They weren't shaking.
Okay. Get in the car.
I just...
Get in the car, Nick. I'm through talking.
Vasco got in the front with Dolly and started driving. Dolly said,
He okay back there?
More or less.
He won't hurt the kid, right?
Nah,
Vasco said. It's just a couple of needles. A few seconds is all.
He better not hurt that kid.
Hey,
Vasco said.
Are you fine about this or what?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay, then. Let's do it.
He drove down the road.
Brad Gordon had a bad feeling as he walked into the Border Cafe on Ventura Boulevard and looked at the booths. The place was a greasy spoon filled with actors. A guy waved from a rear booth. Brad walked back to him. The guy was wearing a light gray suit. He was short and balding and looked unsure of himself. His handshake was weak.
Willie Johnson, he said, I'm your new attorney for the upcoming trial.
I thought my uncle, Jack Watson, was providing the attorney.
He is, Johnson said. I'm he. Pederasty is my specialty.
What's that mean?
Sex with a boy, but I have experience with any underage partner.
I didn't have sex with anybody, Brad said. Underage or not?
I've reviewed your file and the police reports,
Johnson said, pulling out a legal pad.
I think we have several avenues for your defense.
What about the girl?
She is not available. She left the country. Her mother is ill in the Philippines, but I am told she will return for the trial.
I thought there wasn't going to be a trial, Brad said.
The waitress came over. He waved her away.
Why are we meeting here?
I have to be in court in Van Nuys at 10. I thought this would be convenient.
Brad looked around uneasily.
Place is full of people. Actors. They talk a lot.
We won't discuss the details of the case, Johnson said. but I want to lay out the structure of your defense. In your case, I am proposing a genetic defense.
Genetic defense? What's that mean?
People with various genetic abnormalities find themselves helpless to suppress certain impulses, Johnson said. That makes them, in technical terms, not guilty. We will be proposing that as the explanation in your case.
What genetic disorder? I don't have any genetic disorder.
Hey, it's not a bad thing, Johnson said. Think of it as a type of diabetes. You're not responsible for it. You were born that way. In your case, you have an irresistible impulse to engage in sex with attractive young women. He smiled. It's an impulse that's shared by about 90% of the adult male population.
What kind of a fucking defense is that? Brad Gordon said.
A very effective one.
Johnson shuffled through papers in a folder. There have been several recent newspaper reports.
You mean to tell me, Brad said, that there's a gene for sex with young girls?
Johnson sighed.
I wish it were that simple. Unfortunately, no.
Then what's the defense?
D4DR.
Which is?
It's called the novelty gene. It's the gene that drives us to take risks, engage in thrill-seeking behavior. We will argue that the novelty gene inside your body drove you to risky behavior.
Sounds like bullshit to me.
Is it? Let's see. Ever jump out of an airplane?
Yeah, in the army. Hated it.
Scuba diving?
Couple of times. Had a hot girlfriend who liked it.
Mountain climbing?
Nope.
Really? Didn't your high school class climb Mount Rainier?
Yeah, but that was...
You climbed a major American peak,
Johnson said, nodding.
Driving sports cars fast?
Not really, no.
You have 5 tickets for speeding in your Porsche in the last 3 years. Under California law, you've been at risk for losing your license all that time.
Just normal speeding?
I think not. How about sex with the boss's girlfriend?
Well,
and sex with the boss's wife?
Just once, a couple of jobs back. But she was the one who came on to...
Those are risky sex partners, Mr. Gordon. Any jury would agree. How about unprotected sex? Venereal diseases?
Just a minute here, Brad said. I don't want to get into...
I'm sure you don't, Johnson said. And that's not surprising, considering 3 cases of pediculosis pubis, crabs, 2 episodes of gonorrhea, 1 of chlamydia, 2 episodes of condyloma or genital warts, including 1 near the anus. And that's just the last 5 years, according to the records of your doctor in Southern California.
How'd you get those?
Johnson shrugged.
Skydiving, scuba diving, mountain climbing, reckless driving, high-risk sex partners, unprotected sex. If that doesn't comprise a pattern of high-risk, thrill-seeking behavior, I don't know what does.
Brad Gordon was silent. He had to admit the little guy knew how to make a case. He'd never thought of his life that way before. Like when he was screwing the boss's wife, his uncle just gave him hell about it.
Why, his uncle had said, did you make that kind of fucked up decision? Keep it in your pants, jerk off.
Brad had had no answer at the time. Under his uncle's glare, his actions did seem pretty stupid. The broad wasn't even that good looking. But now it seemed Brad had an answer to his uncle's question. He couldn't help it. It was his genetic inheritance that was controlling his behavior. Johnson explained further, giving a lot of detail. According to him, Brad was at the mercy of this D4DR gene, which controlled the chemical levels in the brain.
something called dopamine was driving Brad to take risks and to enjoy the experience, to crave it. Brain scans and other tests prove that people like Brad could not control the desire to take risks.
It's the novelty gene, Johnson said, and it has been named by the most important geneticist in America, Dr. Robert Bellarmino. Dr. Bellarmino is the biggest genetics researcher at the National Institutes of Health. He has a huge lab. He publishes 50 papers a year. No jury can ignore his research.
Okay, so I have the gene.
You really think this will work?
Yes, but I want to see some frosting on the cake before we go to trial.
Meaning what?
Before your trial, you're naturally worried, stressed.
Yeah,
so I want you to take a trip, to take your mind off things. I want you to travel around the country, and I want you to take risks wherever you go.
Johnson laid it out. Speeding tickets, amusement parks, getting into fights, roller coasters, climbing expeditions in national parks, always making sure to get into an argument, a dispute about safety, a claim that equipment was faulty, anything that would get his name recorded in a document that could later be used in trial.
That's it, Johnson said. Get going.
I'll see you in a few weeks.
He gave him a sheet of paper.
What's this?
A list of the biggest roller coasters in the U.S. Make sure you visit the top three.
Christ, Ohio, Indiana, Texas?
I don't want to hear it, Johnson said. You're facing 20 years in prison, my friend, with some big guy with tattoos who's going to be giving you lots worse than anal warts. So do as I tell you, and leave town today.
Back in his apartment in Sherman Oaks, he packed a bag.
The thought of a big guy with tattoos preoccupied him for a moment. He wondered if he should take his pistol, going cross-country to crazy places like Ohio. Who knew what he might come across?
He put a box of ammo in his bag and his pistol with the leg holster. Heading for his car, Brad found that he felt better about everything. It was a sunny day. His Porsche was sparkling clean, and he had a plan.
Road trip.
Lynn Kendall ran into the La Jolla school, arriving out of breath at the principal's office.
"I got here as soon as I could," she said. "What's the problem?"
"It's David," the principal said. She was a woman of 40.
"The child you are homeschooling? Your son Jamie brought him to school for the day."
"Yes, to see how he did."
"And I am afraid he did not do well. On the playground he bit another child."
"Oh, dear."
"He very nearly drew blood."
"That's terrible."
"We see this in homeschooled children, Mrs. Kendall. They severely lack socialization skills and inner controls. There is no substitute for daily school environment with peers."
"I'm sorry this has happened."
"You need to speak to him," the principal said. "He is in detention in the next room."
Lynn went into a small room. It was filled with green metal filing cabinets stacked high. Dave was on a wooden chair, looking very small and brown, curled up in the seat.
"Dave, what happened?"
"He hurted Jamie," Dave said.
"Who did?"
"I don't know his name. He be's in sixth grade,"
Lynn thought. "Sixth grade? Then it would have been a much bigger child."
"And what happened, Dave?"
"He pushed Jamie on the ground. Hurted him."
"And what did you do?"
"I jumped on his back."
"Because you wanted to protect Jamie?"
Dave nodded.
"But you shouldn't bite, Dave."
"He bited me first."
"Did he? Where did he bite you?"
"Here."
Dave held up a stubby, muscular finger. The skin was pale and thick. There might be bite marks, but she couldn't be sure.
"Did you tell the principal?"
"She's not with my mother."
That, Lynn knew, was Dave's way of saying the principal didn't like him.
Young chimps inhabited a matriarchal society where the allegiances of females were very important and constantly tracked.
Did you show her the finger?
Dave shook his head. No.
I'll speak to her, Lynn said.
That's his story, is it?
The principal said.
Well, I'm not surprised.
He jumped on the child's back. What did he expect would happen?
Then the other child did bite first?
Biting is not allowed, Mrs. Kendall.
Did the other child bite him?
He says no.
Is the child in sixth grade?
Yes, in Miss Fromkin's class.
I'd like to speak to him, Lynn said.
We can't permit that, the principal said. He's not your child.
But he's accused Dave, and the situation is very serious. If I am going to deal correctly with Dave, I need to know what happened between them.
I've told you what happened.
You saw it happen?
No, but it was reported by Mr. Arthur, the playground supervisor. He is very accurate in the matter of disputes, I can assure you. The point is, we don't allow biting, Mrs. Kendall.
Lynn was feeling an invisible hand pressing on her. The conversation had a distinct uphill quality.
Perhaps I should talk with my son, Jamie, Lynn said.
Jamie's story will agree with David's, I'm sure. The point is, Mr. Arthur says that it didn't happen that way.
The bigger boy didn't attack Jamie first?
The principal stiffened.
Mrs. Kendall, she said, in cases of disciplinary disputes, we can refer to a security camera on the playground. We can go to that if we need to, now or later. But I would encourage you to stay with the issue of the biting, which is David, however uncomfortable that may be.
I see, Lynn said. The situation was clear. All right. I will deal with Dave when he comes home from school.
I think you should take him with you.
I would prefer he finish the day, she said, and walk home with Jamie.
I don't think
Dave has a problem integrating in the classroom, as you explained, Lynn said. I don't think we help his integration if we pull him out of class now. I will deal with him when he comes home.
The principal nodded reluctantly.
Well,
I will speak to him now, Lynn said, and tell him he'll stay here for the rest of the day.
Alex Burnett jumped out of the cab and ran toward the school. When she saw the ambulance, her heart began to pound. A few minutes before, she had been with a client who was sobbing when the receptionist buzzed to say that Jamie's teacher had called, something about a doctor's visit for her son. The story was garbled, but Alex didn't wait. She handed the client a box of Kleenex and ran. She'd jumped in a cab downstairs and told the guy to run stoplights. The ambulance was at the curb, doors open, a white-coated doctor waiting in the back. She wanted to scream. She had never felt like this before. The world was greenish-white. She was sick with fear. She ran past the ambulance and into the school courtyard. The mother at the front desk said, "Can I help?" But Alex knew where Jamie's classroom was, on the ground floor at the rear courtyard. She headed straight toward it. Her cell phone rang. It was Jamie's teacher, Miss Holloway.
"That woman is waiting outside the class," she whispered. "She gave me a letter with your phone number on it, but I didn't trust that. I used the number we had on your school file and called that."
"Good work," Alex said. "I'm almost there."
"She's outside."
Alex came around the corner and saw a woman in a blue suit standing outside the classroom. Alex went right up to her.
"And who the hell are you?"
The woman smiled calmly, held out her hand.
"Hi, Miss Burnett. Casey Rogers. I'm sorry you had to come all this way." She was so easy, so relaxed. Alex was disarmed. She put her hands on her hips, breathing deeply, catching her breath.
"What seems to be the problem, Casey?"
"There isn't any problem, Miss Burnett."
"You work in my office?"
"Gosh, no. I work in Dr. Hughes's office. Dr. Hughes's wanted me to pick up Jamie and bring him in for his tetanus shot. It's not an emergency, but it does need to be done. He cut his ankle a week ago, isn't that right?"
"No."
"No? Well, I can't imagine. Do you suppose I was sent for the wrong child? Let me call Dr. Hughes. She took out her cell phone. Yes, do that.
Inside the classroom, the kids were looking at them through the glass. She waved to Jamie, who smiled back.
Perhaps we should move away, Casey Rogers said. Not disrupt them.
Then into the phone.
Dr. Hughes, please. Yes, it's Casey.
Together they walked back toward the school entrance. Through the entry arch, Alex saw the ambulance.
Alex said, Did you bring an ambulance? Gosh, no. I have no idea why it's here.
She pointed to the windshield.
Looks like the driver is eating lunch.
Through the windshield, Alex saw a burly man with a black goatee munching on a submarine sandwich. Had he stopped by the school just to eat lunch? Something about that didn't seem right. She couldn't put her finger on it.
Dr. Hughes, it's Casey. Yes, I'm with Miss Burnett right now, and she says her son Jamie did not cut his foot.
He did not, Alex repeated. They walked through the arch and outside, moving closer to the ambulance. The driver put his sandwich on the dashboard and opened the door on the driver's side. He was getting out.
Yes, Dr. Hughes, Casey said. We're leaving the school right now.
She held the phone out to Alex.
Would you like to speak to Dr. Hughes?
Yes, Alex said. As she put the phone to her ear, she heard a piercing electronic shriek. It disoriented her. She dropped the phone as Casey Rogers grabbed her elbows and yanked her arms back. The driver was coming around the front of the ambulance toward her.
We don't need the kid, the driver said. She'll do fine.
It took a moment before she put it together. They were kidnapping her. What happened next was instinct. She slammed her head straight back, hitting Casey in the nose. Casey screamed and let go. Blood gushed down from her nose. Alex grabbed Casey's arm and swung her forward, throwing her at the big man. He sidestepped gracefully as Casey hit the concrete and rolled, howling in pain. Alex fumbled in her pocket. "Get back," she warned him.
"We're not going to hurt you, Miss Burnett," the man said.
He was a good head and a half taller than she, and big, muscular. Just as he reached for her, she got her finger on the button and sprayed pepper in his face.
Shit! God damn it!
He threw his arm up to protect his eyes and half turned away from her. She knew that this was her one chance. She kicked up, fast and hard, hitting him in the throat with her high heel. He yelled in agony, and she fell backward on the sidewalk, unable to keep her balance. She scrambled back to her feet immediately. The woman was getting to her feet, her blood pouring onto the sidewalk. She ignored Alex and went to comfort the big man, who was leaning against the ambulance, bent over, clutching his throat, moaning in pain. Alex heard distant sirens. Someone had called the police, and now the woman was helping the big man into the ambulance, putting him in the passenger seat. It was happening fast. Alex started to worry that these two would get away before the cops showed up, but there wasn't much she could do. As the woman climbed into the ambulance, she screamed at Alex, "We'll arrest you yet!"
"You'll what?"
Alex said. The unreality of this whole incident was starting to hit her.
"You'll what?"
"We'll be back, bitch!" the woman screamed, starting the engine. "You won't get away!" The red flasher came on with a siren. She put the ambulance in gear.
"For what?"
Alex yelled again. All she could think was that this entire business had been some dreadful mistake. But Vern Hughes was her doctor. They had used her correct name. They had come for Jamie.
"No, it was not a mistake. We'll arrest you yet?"
What could that mean? She turned and hurried back into the school. Her one thought now was Jamie. It was snack time. The kids were all sitting at their tables, eating pieces of cut fruit. Some had yogurt. They were quite noisy. Miss Holloway gave her the paper the woman had brought. It appeared to be a Xerox of stationery from Alex's law firm, signed by her. It wasn't a note from the doctor's office. That meant that the woman in the blue suit was a cool operator. When caught, she instantly changed her story, smiling, shaking hands with Alex, smoothly finding an excuse for the two of them to walk back outside, offering her the phone so that when she took it, "We don't need the kid. She'll do fine." They had come to kidnap Jamie, but they were ready to kidnap her instead. Why? Ransom? She had no money to speak of. Was it some lawsuit she was involved in? She'd had dangerous lawsuits in the past, but there wasn't anything pending at the moment. She'll do fine. Either her son or her. Miss Holloway said, "Is there anything I should know, or the school should know?"
"No," Alex said, "but I'm going to take Jamie home.
They've almost finished their snack." Alex nodded to Jamie, waved for him to come over. He came reluctantly.
"What is it, Mom?"
he said. "We need to go."
"I want to stay here."
Alex sighed. Contrary as ever.
"Jamie," she began, "I missed a lot 'cause I was sick. Ask Miss Holloway. And I didn't get to see my friends. I want to stay. And we have hot dogs for lunch."
"I'm sorry," she said. "Go to your cubby and get your stuff. We have to leave." In front of the school, two police cars and four police officers were examining the pavement. One of them said,
"Are you Miss Burnett?"
"Yes, I am."
"We have a report from a woman in the principal's office who saw the whole thing," the policeman said, pointing to a nearby window. "But there's a lot of blood here, Miss Burnett."
"Yes, the woman hurt her nose when she fell."
"Are you divorced, Miss Burnett?"
"Yes, I am."
"For how long?"
5 years.
"So it is not recent."
"Not at all."
"Your relations with your ex?"
"Very cordial."
She talked to the police for a few minutes more while Jamie waited impatiently. The police seemed to Alex to be oddly reluctant to become involved. They were detached and seemed to feel they had come upon a private matter, like a domestic dispute.
"Are you filing a complaint?"
"I would," Alex said, "but I have to take my son home now."
"We can give you the paperwork to take home."
"That will be fine," she said.
One of the cops gave her a business card and said to call if there was anything further she needed. She said she would. Then she and Jamie started home. Out on the street, the world around her suddenly seemed entirely different. Nothing could be more cheerfully bland than the sunlight of Beverly Hills. But now, Alex saw only menace. She didn't know where that menace was coming from or why. She held Jamie's hand. "Are we walking home?" he said, sighing.
"Yes, we're walking."
But even as he asked, she started to wonder. They lived only a few blocks from the school, but was it safe to go home? Would those people with the ambulance be waiting? Or would they hide themselves better the next time?
"It's too far to walk," Jamie trudged along, "and too hot."
"We're walking, and that's all there is to it." As they walked, she flipped open her cell and dialed the office. Her assistant, Amy, answered.
"Listen, I want you to check recent county filings. Find out if my name comes up as a defendant anywhere."
"Is there something I need to know?"
Amy asked, laughing, but it was a nervous laugh. Wrongdoing by an attorney might land their assistants in jail. It had happened a couple of times recently.
"No,"
Alex said, "but I think I have bounty hunters chasing me."
"You jump bail anywhere?"
"No," Alex said. "That's the point. I don't know what these people think they are doing."
The assistant said she would check. Jamie, walking alongside Alex, said,
"What's a bowie hunter? Why is she chasing you, Mom?"
"I'm trying to find out, Jamie. I think it's a mistake."
"Were they trying to hurt you?"
"No, no, nothing like that."
There was no reason to make him worry. The assistant called back. "Okay, you do have a complaint, all right, in Superior Court, Ventura County." That was a good hour from Los Angeles, up past Oxnard.
"What's the complaint?"
"It was filed by Biogen Research Incorporated of Westview Village. I can't read the complaint online, but you're showing up as a failure to appear."
"Appear when?"
"Yesterday."
"Was I served?"
"Indicates you were."
I wasn't, Alex said. Shows you were. So, is there a contempt citation? A warrant for my arrest?
Nothing showing, but the online lags up to a day, so there might be.
Alex flipped the phone shut. Jamie said, Are you going to be arrested?
No, honey, I'm not.
Then can I go back to school after lunch?
We'll see.
Her apartment building on the north side of Roxbury Park looked quiet in the midday sun. Alex stood on the other side of the park and watched for a while.
Why are we waiting? Jamie said. Just for a minute. It's been a minute already.
No, it hasn't.
She was watching the man in coveralls going around the side of the house. He looked like the meter reader for the utility company, except that he was big with a bad wig and a trimmed black goatee that she had seen somewhere before, and the meter readers never came to the front. They always entered from the back alley. She was thinking that if this guy was a bounty hunter, he had the right to enter her property without warning and without a warrant. He could break down the door if he wanted to. He had the right to search her apartment, to go through her things, to take her computer and inspect the hard drive. He could do whatever he wanted to do to apprehend a fugitive. But she wasn't a...
Can we go in, Mom? Jamie whined. Please?
Her son was right about one thing. They couldn't just stand there. There was a sandbox in the middle of the park, several kids, maids, and mothers sitting around.
Let's go play in the sandbox.
I don't want to.
Yes.
It's for babies. Just for a while, James. He stamped his foot and sat down on the edge of the sandbox. He kicked sand irritably while Alex dialed her assistant. Amy, I am wondering about Biogen, the company that bought my father's cell line. We don't have any motions pending, do we?
No.
California Supreme Court is a year from now.
So what's going on, she wondered. What kind of suit was Biogen bringing now?
Call the judge's clerk up in Ventura. Find out what this is about.
Okay.
Have we heard from my father?
Not for a while.
Okay.
It actually wasn't okay, because she was now having the strong feeling that all this had to do with her father, or at least with her father's cells. The bounty hunters had brought an ambulance with a doctor in the back because they were going to take a sample or do some surgical procedure. Long needles. She'd seen sunlight glint on long needles wrapped in plastic as the doctor at the back of the ambulance shuffled things about. Then it hit her. They wanted to take their cells. They wanted cells from her or from her son. She couldn't imagine why, but they clearly felt entitled to take them. Should she call the police? Not yet, she decided. If there were a warrant for her failure to appear, they'd simply take her into custody. And then what would she do about Jamie? She shook her head. Right now, she needed time to figure out what was going on. Time to get everything straightened out. What was she supposed to do? She wanted to call her father, but he hadn't been answering for days. If these guys knew where she lived, they would know what kind of car she had and...
Amy, she said, how'd you like to drive my car for a couple of days?
The BMW, sure, but...
And I'll drive yours, Alex said. But you need to bring it over to me.
Stop that, Jamie. Stop kicking sand.
Are you sure? It's a Toyota with a bunch of dents.
Actually, that sounds perfect.
Come to the southwest side of Roxbury Park and pull over in front of a white Spanish apartment building with wrought iron gates in front. Alex was unprepared by temperament and training for the situation in which she now found herself. All her life had been spent in the sunlight. She obeyed the rules. She was an officer of the court. She played the game. She didn't run yellow lights. She didn't park in the red. She didn't cheat on her taxes. At the firm, she was regarded as by the book, stodgy. She told clients, "Rules are made to be followed, not twisted." And she meant it. 5 years earlier, when she discovered her husband was screwing around on her,
She threw him out within an hour of learning the truth. She packed his bag and put it outside the door and had the locks changed. When he came back from his fishing trip, she spoke through the door and told him to get lost. Matt was actually screwing one of her best friends. That was Matt's way, and she never again spoke to that woman. Of course, Jamie had to see his father, and she made sure that happened. She delivered her son to Matt at the appointed time, on the dot. Not that he ever returned her son on time, but it was Alex's view that the world stabilized one person at a time. If she did her part, she felt eventually others might do theirs. At work, she was called idealistic, impractical, unrealistic. She responded that in lawyer speak, realistic was another word for dishonest. She stuck to her guns. But it was true that sometimes she felt she limited herself to the kind of cases that did not challenge her illusions. The head of the firm, Robert A. Koch, had said as much.
"You're like a conscientious objector, Alex. You let other people do the fighting, but sometimes we have to fight. Sometimes we can't avoid conflict."
Koch was an ex-Marine like her father. Same kind of rough-and-tumble talk, proud of it. She had always shrugged it off. Now she wasn't shrugging anything off. She didn't know what was going on, but she felt pretty sure she couldn't just talk her way out of it. She was sure nobody was going to stick a needle into her or her son. To prevent that, she would do whatever had to be done. Whatever had to be done. She replayed in her mind the incident at the school. She hadn't had a gun. She didn't own a gun, but she wished she had had one. She thought, if they were trying to do something to my son, could I have killed them? And she thought, yes, I could have killed them. And she knew it was true. A white Toyota Highlander with a battered front bumper pulled up. She saw Amy sitting in the car. Alex said, "Jamie, let's go."
"Finally!"
He started toward their apartment, but she steered him in another direction. "Where are we going?" "We're taking a little trip," she said.
"Where?"
He was suspicious. "I don't want to take a trip." Without hesitation, she said, "I'll buy you a PSP. She had steadfastly refused for a year to buy him one of those electronic game things, but now she was just saying whatever came to mind.
"For real? Hey, thanks!"
More frowns. "But which games? I want Tony Hawk 3, and I want Shrek." "Whatever you want," she said. "Let's just get in the car. We're going to drive Amy back to work."
"And then? Where are we going then?"
"Legoland," she said. The first thing that came into her mind. Driving back to the office, Amy said, "I brought your father's package. I thought you might want it."
"What package?"
"It came to the office last week. You never opened it. You were at trial with the Mick Crowley rape case. You remember that political reporter who likes little boys?" It was a small FedEx box. Alex tore it open, dumped the contents on her lap. A cheap cellular phone, the kind you bought and put a card in, 2 prepaid telephone cards, a tinfoil-wrapped packet of cash, 5,000 in $100 bills, and a cryptic note: "In case of trouble, don't use your credit cards. Turn off your cell phone. Don't tell anyone where you are going. Borrow somebody's car. Page me when you are in a motel. Keep Jamie with you." Alex sighed.
That son of a bitch.
"What is it?" "Sometimes my father annoys me," she said. Amy didn't need to hear details. "Listen, today's Thursday. Why don't you take a long weekend?" "That's what my boyfriend wants to do," she said. "He wants to go to Pebble Beach and watch the old car parade."
"That's a great idea," Alex said. "Take my car."
"Really? I don't know. What if something happened to it? I got in an accident or something."
"Don't worry about it," Alex said. "Just take the car."
Amy frowned. There was a long silence. "Is it safe?"
"Of course it's safe."
"I don't know what you're involved in," she said.
"It's nothing.
It's a mistaken identity thing. It'll be worked out by Monday, I promise you. Bring the car back Sunday night, and I'll see you in the office Monday.
For sure?
Absolutely,
Amy said. Can my boyfriend drive?
Absolutely.
Georgia Bellarmino would never have known if it hadn't been for the cereal box. Georgia was on the phone with a client in New York, an investment banker who had just gotten a DOE appointment. They were talking about the house he was buying for his family move to Rockville, Maryland. Georgia, who was best-selling realtor of the year in Rockville for 3 years running, was busy going over the terms of the purchase when her 16-year-old daughter, Jennifer, called from the kitchen. Mom, I'm late for school. Where's the cereal?
On the kitchen table.
No, it's not.
Look again.
Mom, it's empty. Jimmy must have eaten it.
Mrs. Bellarmino covered the phone with her hand. Then get another box, Jen, she said. You're 16. You're not helpless.
Where is it?
Jennifer said, banging doors in the kitchen.
Look above the oven,
Mrs. Bellarmino said.
I did. It's not there.
Mrs. Bellarmino told the client she'd call back and walked into the kitchen. Her daughter was wearing low-cut jeans and a sheer top that looked like something a hooker would wear to work. These days, even junior high girls dress that way. She sighed.
Look above the oven, Jen.
I told you I did.
Look again.
Mom, will you just get it for me? I'm late.
Mrs. Bellarmino stood firm.
Above the oven. Jennifer reached up, opening the doors, stretching for the cereal box, which was right there, of course. But Mrs. Bellarmino was not looking at the box. She was looking at her daughter's exposed stomach.
Jen, you have those bruises again.
Her daughter brought the box down, tugged at her top, covering her belly.
It's nothing.
You had them the other day, too.
Mom, I'm late.
She was walking to the table, sitting down.
Jennifer, show me.
With an exasperated sigh, her daughter stood and lifted her top, exposing her abdomen. Mrs. Bellarmino saw an inch-long horizontal bruise just above the bikini line, and another one, fainter, on the other side of the belly.
It's nothing, Mom. I just keep banging into the edge of the desk.
But you shouldn't bruise.
It's nothing.
Are you taking your vitamins?
Mom, can I please just eat?
You know you can tell me anything. You know that.
Mom, you're making me late for school. I have a French test.
There was no point in pushing her now. In any case, the phone had started ringing. No doubt the New York client telephoning back. Clients were impatient. They expected realtors to be available every minute of the day. She went into the other room to take the call and opened her documents to review the numbers. 5 minutes later, her daughter yelled, "Bye, Mom!" and Georgia heard the front door slam. It left her distinctly uneasy. She just had a feeling. She dialed her husband's lab in Bethesda. For once, Rob was not in meetings, and she was put right through. She told him the story.
"What do you think we should do?"
she asked.
"Search her room," he said promptly. "We have an obligation."
"Okay,"
she said. "I'll call the office and tell them I'll be late."
"I'm flying later," he said. "But let me know."
Barton Williams' Boeing 737 rolled to a